Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Garton Institute Foundation this afternoon for the second in our series on the Architecture of Prosperity, part of the Culture of Prosperity programme that I administer here at the Institute. The first of the seminars, issued forth rather magnificently in this report under the banner of the Culture of Prosperity, are proposals on the future of the Mount Pleasant Circus of Beat Valley Garden site, a subject of great controversy, largely instigated by ourselves in the press and elsewhere. And you can read all about it once we've printed even more copies of this sensational document. And the next programme in the series, the next event in the series, before I forget, will be when I will be in a conversation with Jonathan Meads on the 25th of November on the meaning of the Garton, the meaning of legacy, especially, of course, in regard to architecture. But today our concern is with the suburbs, specifically London and its suburbs. Suburb, suburban, suburbia. What a wealth of contradictory and therefore uniquely British images are summed up by those words. Because, as we all know, the suburb is where Margot lives, where Margot Ledbetter delighted the nation with her clipped accents way back when in the 1970s. That is a place, apparently, where the accents are as clipped as the hedges, where the drives are immaculately kept, where lives are ordered, decent, and suburban. But as observers of the good life would have learnt, it is also a place where surprising things happen behind and beneath the clipped hedges, where experiments in horticulture, where experiments in living are embarked upon by Tom and Barbara Good. Barbara, listen, limbed, and Tom, always encased in that sweater. Had you been to the Dartford equivalent of Life with the Goods at some time in the 1960s, you would have discovered, for example, young Master Jagger, son of the PE teacher at Dartford Grammar School, dreaming of the future, without a care for the future, and without a thought of Bianca on the horizon. The suburb is often a place of great creativity. It is a place, after all, that gave us catwalk Queen of Croydon, Kate Moss, not to mention David Bowie, then in those days, in Bromley, David Jones, of Ziggy Stardust fame, and much else besides. 40 years ago, a very famous film by John Betjeman, called Metroland, disclosed to many of us for the first time the hidden delights, the occluded pleasures, and the secret passions of Metroland, the suburbs, the north of London. We have been very fortunate this afternoon to gather together a great array of voices who will be contributing to this colloquium on the theme of London and its suburbs, its delights, its passions, and its future. And I'm going to start by listening to Rupert Hook, who is a professional concerned with the suburbs as a senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Kingston, but also has a political and administrative concern with the dormitory suburbs, it was once known as, of Ealing, a place where the Welsh arrived in great numbers for their suburban lives from the late 19th and early 20th century onwards. All is very big Welsh community in Ealing, now greatly supplemented by Poles, I think, as well. So what could be better than a combination of Welsh and Poles? And she is also, I think, now has been adopted as the prospective parliamentary candidate for the Labour Party in the constituency of Ealing Central.
And Acton.
Let us know from Acton. Not only the name of a great historian, but also the name of a rather important diplomat. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a very pleasure for me to introduce Rupa Hooke this afternoon.
Thanks very much. Look, I'm going to stand up because then you might be able to see me. I mean, you probably still can't see me, although I'm standing up. But anyway, look, I've called this, I think on the programme, I'm down as old stereotypes versus modern suburbs. But I've actually titled it Representations and Realities of Suburban Society. It could also be called What Do We Do with a Problem Like Suburbia? I mean, look, by way of background, and available in all good bookshops, and some bad ones, and those tax-dodging websites, I mean, as an academic, I started off looking at the sociology of youth culture and at pop music, so that was my first book, Beyond Subculture. And then the second one was a kind of sociology of the suburbs, because there's reams and reams of urban sociology. And I do feel that part of the problem of suburbia, what do we do with a problem like suburbia, is that it's not perceived as a problem. There's lots of urban sociology about people living in high-rise hell with urban malaise or whatever. But because the suburbs are just there, they're not seen as problematic. They're seen as, well, I've got a slide that will illustrate this more quickly than I can say this. But the two sides of sort of looking at popular culture, I do feel sociology tends to approach things in problem-solving terms. So even youth studies is about the problem of delinquent youth and subcultures and those kind of things. Whereas there's a sub-branch of sociology that then became a bastardised thing with English literature that turned into cultural studies, stroke media studies. So that's the third book, which is sort of looking at suburbia through popular cultural representations. So look, I mean, actually, this nobody's ever seen this. This is the first time ever in public. Bloomsbury, when I proposed the book on popular culture in suburbs, these were their initial covers that they gave me, and I said back to the drawing board, I don't like those big fat TVs. They're not representative of what people watch now. And this one on the right, this idea, it looks a bit Mad Men, doesn't it? Sort of 50s American suffocating life of the housewife, bit Betty Friedan, all those things. And I think these are, I mean, in a way, okay, there's no commonly agreed definition of what a suburb is. We know that a recession is when an economy has been through two quarters of negative growth. We don't really know what a suburb is, but we know what it is because of what it isn't. So, I mean, if you can read that faster than I can read that out. But, and I know that there are dangers of dichotomies and binary oppositions and all these things. But in a way, you know you're suburban when it's not quirky, bohemian, exciting, and it's homogeneic, conformist, and it's quite frankly boring. So, I mean, these are the sort of, you know, it's, I think, hang on, this next one. Okay, if we distill, so those were the binary oppositions there. That you've made it when you move to suburbia. It's a place of affluence compared to multiple deprivation districts people talk about in sociology, overcrowding, poor health, all those sort of things. So you can sort of distill that to it's of the city but not of its core. So, yeah, somewhere you don't really want to go, a bit out of the way. And this idea that nothing ever happens there. So these unremarkable, out-of-the-way places. Unlike, I mean, I must point out that this is a sort of Anglo-Saxon idea of suburbia. The French banlieue is a place of danger, and that's quite a different thing altogether. So, and yeah, this is kind of what it looks like. So we've seen a lot of words so far, but that's sort of Acacia Avenue, the rain in Rains Park, that sort of thing. And I would say also that it's a pejorative term. So it's not a neutral word that it's somewhere that's at the edge of the city, not in its centre. But just the word suburban is often uttered with sniffy disdain. You know, don't be so suburban if you turn up late. Don't give me your suburban excuses, that kind of thing. And this is illustrated by this, it doesn't show very well on the slide, but it's a time sketch from 2013 when Ed Miliband did a talk and took Q&A afterwards, and the general public and journalists were in there, and some Labour Party members. And I sort of put my hand up at the end, and I said, you know, do you have a strategy for suburbs? Because on some estimates, even though we don't know what it is, 8 out of 10 of us now live there, and, you know, there are some very real 21st century problems. What are you going to do to address the suburbs? And I think he said something about housing in answer. But the way it was written up in the sketch was Ed Miliband did a talk. A furious woman at the back put up her hand and said, what is One Nation Labour doing for suburbs? And he said, homes. But what a stupid answer, because she wanted to hear gnomes, because that's what people in suburbs want. Gnomes, not homes. Silly man, Ed Miliband. And that's not what happened at all. And it just illustrates a long line of, you know, there's George Orwell in Coming Up for Air, who calls where he lives that street line of semi-detached torture chambers all in a row. There's so many examples we can find. Popular culture is littered with them. Yet, I want to argue that suburbs are where everything interesting happens, like pop music. So, oh, hang on, wait, this is not what I thought it would be. Never mind. Oh, okay, sorry, I thought I'd added a few more pictures this morning. Never mind, okay. So, I mean, the Jam sang In the City. So it's cool and trendy to be associated with the sprawling, the metropolis, the non-sprawling bit, the bit at the centre. So people like, you know, we've had, I mean, you mentioned Huell in your introduction, the Stones, all those binary things, Beatles versus Stones, Oasis versus Blair, Freudian slip, was it? Freudian landslide, I think. Oasis versus Blair, I've done it twice in a row, dearie me. Okay, or Lennon versus McCartney, any of those binary oppositions, they're all suburban, and I feel a bit like, you remember that programme, Goodness Gracious Me, there was an Indian dad who would say of every invention, Indian, that's what it is, Indian, and I feel like that about suburban. I mean, I'm someone who lives and works in the suburbs. I live in Ealing, I take the 65 bus every day to Kingston, well, not every day, I'm not there now, but I mean, on the whole, so yeah, pop music, and I had a nicer picture that's not here, but you can imagine it. There's the Lennon and McCartney's boyhood homes. One was corporation suburbia, the sort of homes fit for heroes, those interwar council estates between the First Great War, a lot of them came, built on the garden suburb principle. And the other was a 30-semi Auntie Mimi's house. If you've seen that film about him, that's in there a lot. So there are different types of suburbias. And this album cover from the early 90s about post-punk also shows it. So you've got your corporation suburbia, suburban council house with front and back gardens there, and then you've got the classic semis in pairs in the middle. And also, the other slide that's not made it on here is a kind of rock family trees thing of all the genres and subgenres and derivations, and they're all suburban. I mean, before R Price and HMV disappeared from the high street, they had a category called urban. You couldn't do one called suburban because the whole blooming shop would be suburban. Everything is suburban. And it's something that people deny their suburban roots. So again, Oasis, they were from Burnage, which is one of these sort of things at the bottom. Although the way they made out was that they were sort of living in high-rise hell or whatever. This is showing the changes in the sort of almost dissolution of distance. So before, this idea, the proposed cover of Bloomsbury with wifey at home getting everything ready for the kids to come home from school, and hi honey, I'm home with his hat coming home from work. It doesn't work so much anymore because people can work from anywhere. So on a day that I don't have to do this standing up and PowerPointing, I can be anywhere. I mean, not even just because of broadband, but with a sort of smartphone, you can, you know, these Shackleberry things, you're never out of the office anymore. So those kind of things, I think, matter less and less. This is showing a Guardian comment is free, which is saying London's soul is in the suburbs. So again, sort of this idea of white flight, so I think all that's reversed as well. So, I mean, it's the outer suburbs that have... It was UKIP themselves who said that London was immune to the UKIP tide, and they all voted Labour because over there they're all young, cultured and educated. That's in their own words, not mine. But, I mean, sort of, it's the places like Harrow, East and West. I think they used to be very... even the Croydons, they were classic suburban developments in the beginning, but they're actually very cosmopolitan, diverse, whatever you call it. The word, you know, suburban diversity is no longer an oxymoron. It's a given sort of thing. So I was meant to be 10 minutes, wasn't I? How long have we got?
It's not still 10 minutes,
though. No, there's more. Yeah. There's a couple more, I think, but it's not what I thought it'd be. Anyway, look, so suburbs have witnessed riots. I mean, it was a bit surreal to have live feeds both from Ealing and Croydon in August 2011, wasn't it? I mean, you could get into a big argument about when is a riot not a riot. Was that opportunistic looting and people nicking trainers and not actually, like the granny said in... Hackney, do it for a cause, people, do it for a cause. But, I mean, that's probably another presentation for another day. Again, the decline of the high street. So, I mean, part of a defining feature of the suburb was it had its own shops and that kind of thing. But sort of some of these high streets are looking a bit down at hill. I think the recessionary climbs have not been good to suburbia. And interestingly, I mean, I find these things are coming... It's not a post bag as such, but into my inbox as a candidate, people are lobbying about lots of planning issues and no to Tesco's, that kind of thing has been a big issue. Look, the two things... So we're saying that there's been a wellsprung of popular culture from the suburbs that's been under-acknowledged, I would say. This is... Do you know where that is? Actually, it says on the right. Croydon, yes. So that's a sort of early picture postcard of Croydon. And now it's the home of... dubstep, which is a popular musical movement. And so sort of all these things coalesce, I think, in dubstep. And I imagine the one underneath... No, I didn't save it. Okay, I thought I had. Okay, there was a really good picture at the end. But anyway, I should have a killer conclusion, really, shouldn't I? So, I mean, I think that we should be proud of being from suburbia. I mean, again, when I went to university, I went to Cambridge for my degree, and I would sort of euphemise the word Ealing and say, West London, and that makes it sound like it could be Notting Hill or somewhere much more cool and trendy. But I've sort of gone the other way now, and 8 out of 10 of us, it's estimated, live in suburbia. So it's time to take suburbs seriously, not just see them as the preserve of the net curtains and the, I don't know, the doily over the toilet roll and those sort of unpleasant things. Because without us noticing, suburbs have changed into something unrecognisable. And maybe with the gentrification of the inner city, so all those what were multiple occupancy houses being converted back into single family units, we've actually seen an inversion of those stereotype, those binaries of suburb equals danger and diverse. Yes, that is what it is now, isn't it? Inner city equals people who can afford to live there, sort of thing. So, I think I should have a killer conclusion. So this is it. If you want to see the real England, forget Stonehenge, Buckingham Palace or Big Ben. Instead, go to Solihull, Didsbury or Heston, because that is where the nation's heart truly beats in 2014.
Right, so what do they in England know who only Stonehenge know? And there will be an opportunity to check up on the West London dimension when Ed Vasey joins us later on.
Ah, yes, he's...
So we can compare notes
and make sure that... And Neil Kinnock was a good Welshman who didn't find his way off the M4 and stayed in Ealing.
He was perennially in Ealing, so, yes. And yes. I'm still there. And the London Welsh branch of that society as well. Rupert, you've introduced us in a dazzling way to the kaleidoscopic connection of the imagery that comes between us and the realities of life. We always, I think, seem to be interpreting suburbia, those who are not necessarily living there all the time, and the speed of this development can really capture us quite unawares. And it's to this theme of the imagery of a suburb that will be the preoccupation of our next speaker from the London Transport Museum, Oliver Green. These images of the 30s and 40s speak a world, well, this really is the world of Marco, isn't it? I mean, it is very thick, it's very safe, it's very secure. It's a place of solidity and sturdiness, and it will be a place where many people called Bray live from time to time. So over to you now, Oliver, for how the shaping of the suburbs and the transportation, and especially I think the two, changed everything.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm not sure the suburbs are a problem, I have to say. I think they're very interesting. I agree with a lot of what Rupert has said, but I think some of those stereotypes were off-being and probably still are off-being, and certainly the suburbs have changed. What I wanted to concentrate on today, without necessarily coming to any obvious conclusions, but just to go back and look at the history of the suburbs in London and how they came about. Because it seems to me that whatever you think of the suburbs, the essence of having suburbs around a great city like London is to do with mobility. The suburbs are all about transport and moving. You couldn't have suburbs unless you had a way of getting into the main city. And despite what Rupert said, I'm not entirely sure that suburbs could exist in their own right. They are dependent on an interaction with the central city. And even those popular cultural things are. It may be true that Mick Jagger and the others did come from the suburbs, but if you remember, he met Keith Richards on a train into central London, and most of the playing that they did was not in the suburbs, it was in central London clubs. So that sort of interaction with the suburbs is what's essential. And certainly in earlier periods, it was entirely based on public transport. But going right back to the 19th century, when London, of course, was far and away the biggest city in the world, and it had been since the beginning of the 19th century, since before there was any urban transport, by the end of the 19th century, when London begins to expand outwards quite dramatically, there had been suburbs before, but they'd all been really walkable suburbs. But from the mid-19th century onwards, the expansion of London is almost entirely linked with the development of railways. Initially, there were mainline railways, but then quite soon, the railways realised that actually there was much more potential for new development linked to their lines, and they started opening stations just outside London in the suburbs. And there's a classic example of a complete transformation of a scene. The photograph at the top right is Neasden, circa 1890. The photograph below I took a couple of years ago from exactly the same spot. The only thing that you can still see which is in there is... Well, you can, I can't, oh, that is working now. There, you see the station. That's Kingsbury and Neasden Station, as it was then called. Down here, there are a few bits left of the same station. Basically, it's in the same place. The railway has expanded to 6 tracks now, and everything else has been covered. At that time, Neasden was entirely a greenfield site, as you can see in 1890. Now, the only grass is that between the tracks. The photograph is actually taken from the overbridge on the North Circular Road, which developed in the 1920s. It wasn't even there at the time that early photograph was taken. All of that development is entirely a result of the Metropolitan Railway having extended itself from its original central London location out northwest through the suburbs, and the suburbs began to follow it out. And that move and the creation of what we now call suburbia really only happened from the very end of the 19th century, and in particular, it began to take off in the first decade of the 20th century. And the railways, as they started realising there was actually new traffic to be gained here, and started promoting the delights of living either in the suburbs or in the country, and commuting into London. Because they hadn't been set up for commuting at all, but that became a characteristic of suburbia as it grew, that it was somewhere where you lived, but you actually went to work in the city, and you did it by train. Because, of course, no one had a car in those days. And there you see two sides of London. That's Leytonstone Station, which is now part of the Tube, but in those days was part of the Great Eastern Railway, top right there. And you can see the picture is actually very specifically titled. That's 9:18 a.m., seems a bit late to me, actually. I think you actually should be there a bit earlier to be getting a train into the city. The one down bottom right is not that far away from where Rupert is now. That's what was then called Coombe and Malden Station, now New Malden Station. That's on the line in to Waterloo and also from Kingston. And you can see there, again, it's crowded with commuters. Interestingly, only one woman, I think, amongst them. And in the top one, I don't think there are any. But the notion of living just outside London in a suburb like Kingston or like Leytonstone or any number of other places, which were gradually joined to London, and you went from home to city by train, became a characteristic, I suppose, of suburban life. And the railways actually started encouraging suburban development. And this, in particular, really was promoted by the Tube when that arrived in the early 1900s. And the first Tube suburb, I think one could say, is Golders Green, which, for me, always was an important place, actually. I mean, I'm a suburban boy myself. I was brought up in North London. Golders Green, in my youth in the 60s, was a hot spot of the suburbs. It's where you went every Saturday night to find where the party's going on. And way back at the time that the Tube first reached Golders Green, at the time it was just a crossroads in the countryside, just north of Hampstead, almost as soon as the Tube arrived, and that was the end of the line at that time, it was where the Tube came out into the open, a suburb developed very fast. And Golders Green was talked about as a sort of township, in a way, because it had all the facilities of a town of its own, but it was linked by a 20-minute fast tube journey to the West End and the city. and Hampstead Garden Suburb developed at the same time, just nearby. That poster was issued by the Underground a year after the station opened, that's 1908. And you can see it's a sort of early ideal of the arts and crafts suburb there. The man has got home early enough to be able to walk home from a tube at the end of the road and start watering his garden, and his wife and baby are just sitting there in the garden. And Gold's Green is, soon as reached any time, a place of delightful prospects, which I'm sure it was. But almost immediately, the Gold's Green had developed and become a town almost in its own right. It had a huge theatre, still has, it got the Hippodrome in, had a cinema, it had rows of shops, and it had a lot of semi-detached residences like that in early garden suburb mode. Hampstead Garden Suburb, of course, which was a sort of experimental suburban development, which was supposed to be for all classes, very quickly actually became rather select, and of course has remained very select ever since, which is why, although I agree with the ideas of garden suburb development, which we've now talked about again, garden city development, as various political parties are now talking about, I'm not quite sure how well it's going to work and whether it's actually going to have the same problems again. But you can see it was being promoted very much by the Underground. At that time, it was a private company, of course, like all the railways, and they saw the potential for making money out of suburban development and promoted the idea of these new healthy homes. They're on the right-hand side, on the District Line, out at Austerley and Hounslow. The interesting thing about that is you'll see it's promoting how quickly you can get into the city. The fares are allegedly cheap, and it mentions low rents. At this time, and this is still just before the First World War, hardly anybody owned their own property, even in the suburbs. They rented, and that's the big new development when the suburbs really take off in the 1920s, after they've extended and electrified the old metropolitan lines. They extended a new line out in West London beyond Harrow as far as Uxbridge, electrified it in a rather cumbersome way to begin with, so that actually they weren't ready in time. They had steam trains for 6 months. But 6 months later, in 1904, they opened their first electric services from way out at Uxbridge. That station, which at that stage is just called a halt, as you can see, it's in an open countryside, that's Ickenham. And for any of you who know suburban West London, Ickenham is completely covered in suburban houses now. When they first opened the line, there were no houses there at all. In the 1920s, it was very quickly built up. And the Metropolitan, which developed northwest London suburbs, came up during the First World War, actually, with this brilliant name, Metroland, which their publicity department thought up. They launched it with a publicity book in the middle of the First World War in 1915. Not the best time to promote suburban development, you might think, but they did. And it didn't work very well to begin with. But after the First World War, they cashed in on this Homes Fit for Heroes idea. And they started developing through a subsidiary company, suburban estates next to their railway stations, which was a brilliant idea. They were the only railway company that did it. The main underground company never did do it. And Metroland was very heavily promoted, and it became both a blessing and a curse in many ways. It's become a sort of synonym for suburbia. But at the time, it was enormously successful, and the Metropolitan became the first successful commuter railway with this sideline in suburban development, because not only had it got a captive market of commuters who moved out to these new houses, but they actually sold them the houses. And in the same Metroland book, you could find building societies who were then taking off at a rate of knots in the 20s, who could offer you very low rate mortgages. And for the first time, people began to be able to buy their own houses. Most of those new houses they were buying were in suburbia. Of course, it was only the middle classes who were able to do that. But nevertheless, for an awful lot of people, suburbs meant a completely new life, really.
Wasn't Scotland before World War One? Was it lack of sales of houses or lack of capital and loans to do so?
I think it was a combination of the two. I don't think they quite realised how it might take off. And one of the things that certainly influenced them was when the Tube developed, the main underground company, it was promoted by an American, Charles Tyson Yerkes. Yerkes made a lot of money out of both electrification of tramways and urban railways in Chicago and promoting what the Americans call streetcar suburbs. That's having a real estate development at the end of the tram line or the railway line. That had never really happened in Britain, but it worked in the States. When he came over and built up the underground company, that was exactly what he was hoping would happen with Gold's Green. Unfortunately, Yerkes himself died before he was able to make money out of it personally. And he was also a very shifty character, and the way in which he financed the underground was all a bit dodgy, shall we say. But were it not for this rogue Yerkes, we probably wouldn't have the underground system we have. But it was very much on the principle that had been developed in the States, which people in this country just couldn't quite believe it would happen. And it was actually based on international finance, interestingly. He persuaded people that if you invested in the underground, you would make money out of it one way or another. That wasn't actually true, because we didn't in the end. I mean, no metro system actually makes a profit. But that's the way it started out. And by the 20s, when we're into an economic depression shortly after the First World War, but before the next big depression, the underground persuades the government, and this was the first way in which central government starts to get involved, that a way of reviving the economy, and I wonder why we don't do this again actually, but a way of reviving the economy was to build new extensions to the London Underground out into the suburbs that would create economic benefits for industry around the country. It would revive the building trade, and it would also enable people to get new houses because London had a housing problem. And the Underground themselves, still a private company, couldn't afford to do it unless they were allowed to borrow money against a Treasury guarantee, which the government gave them. So it was a sort of hidden subsidy to the development of London's transport infrastructure, which we're almost back to now, I think. So in the 20s, they extended beyond Golders Green, which was the first one, what later became known as the Northern Line, then called the Hampstead Tube, out to Edgware. And there were posters like this issued by the Underground that didn't even need a caption because it's obvious what was going on. Housing, building, development would follow the tube. There's the new tube station just opening. There's building activity going on all around. And there beyond is the countryside, which of course is the downside of this. The countryside is then receding. So after a while of initially promoting Edgware, for example, as somewhere to live and move out of what's suggested as being rather crowded. I mean, that would be a much more expensive place to live now than Edgware. That's probably Islington or somewhere.
Yeah.
rather ironic, really, but promoted that you could live in Edgware, which is sort of in the countryside, but not quite, and you can get into central London.
That's, we need to move into the discussion, I suppose.
Yes. Let me move straight on. So, a new lifestyle in the suburbs. There's Edgware Station in the 20s. And again, mainly middle class, but all those people are reliant on the transport system to bring them back home. That's taken on a Saturday, so they're coming home from work on a Saturday. And one of those guys in the middle has changed into his cricket gear already. The others are going home on the bus. And on the same line, as well as all this private housing development, the London County Council also starts developing social housing. That's the Watling Estate at Burnt Oak, the biggest North London council housing estate, opened in the 20s, right by the Tube. Down bottom left there, that's in Barking and Dagenham, which became the biggest ever housing estate in London. I suspect most of those houses there have been bought now in, under right to buy. What they didn't do was put in a proper transport system for that. They didn't put in the trams, which they should have done. And the same happened in South London. That's Morden in the 30s, end at the Tube line. That's taken in 1936. All of that housing in the background there had been built in the 10 years since the Tube opened. And the transport operation, the London General, were operating bus services from further out in South London, and everybody would come in on the buses, then change onto the Tube and get there in time to get a workman's ticket, and it became the busiest Tube station in outer London. Some of it, the Underground and London Transport, actually developed in what I think was probably the best modern architecture in London at the time. My great hero of the day was Frank Pick, who was the first chief executive of London Transport, who actually promoted with his architect Charles Holden a completely new style for the suburbs. It didn't actually affect most housing development, but it certainly affected the look of what became effectively civic centres like Southgate there, and what have been former villages. So at the end of the 30s, London had grown like it had never grown before. It's the period of real suburban boom. It all came to a complete stop with the Second World War. And after the war, most of what London Transport had been planning to do in the way of development never took place. And my own feeling is that London and its suburbs went into complete decline there. The transport system was not well run. It was nationalised and it was part of a great operation called the British Transport Commission. London lost out after the war, and the concentration, rather than on developing the suburbs or anything else, was on creating a greenbelt and moving out to new towns outside London. And developments which could have helped London suburbs just didn't happen. Top right there is the bit of the Tube that was started before the war but never happened. That's what is now a rather nice urban pathway through the suburbs of Crouch End and Muswell Hill. It was where the Tube was going to run to take you to Muswell Hill. It never happened, and that's now just a pathway. You can see rusting away at the middle there what would have carried the cables. But Muswell Hill will never be on the Tube now because they built a school and various other things on the route. We've recently, and this is coming leaping forward up to say, after doing nothing virtually for London's transport for 50-odd years, we've realised that actually one of the ways of improving London's suburbs and finding ways around it is to build the overground network. So that rather than all the routes out of London being radial, you can now actually get around London. I remember what that line used to be like 40 years ago when it was, you'd fear for your life to go on it. But it's one of the recent brilliant developments now have a radial rail system around London, much more useful than the M25 will ever be, and we probably need to build another one. And actually suburban development has now moved way outside London altogether, and this is something I was going to ask Ed about later when he arrives, but the new housing development is not happening in London suburbs, it's happening out beyond the London suburbs. That's actually on the line out from Marylebone. Again, it's transport based. You can see new housing going up there at Haddon and Thames Parkway. And this is all classic ex-suburban territory, I suppose.
Thank you, Oliver.
Yes.
Sorry, a thralling journey through past and present by two affording so many delightful prospects. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much.